Happy hump day, everybody. Hope you're doing well out there. Welcome inside our ESPN studios here in Northern Nevada. Happy to be with you today on this Wednesday, May 20th. We got some interesting stuff on the docket for today's show. We're going to talk about some of the fallout now from the Last Dance documentary and how some players are reacting to it. Some of the players from those from that Chicago Bulls team and from that era of the Chicago Bulls, one man in particular, but we'll talk about some of the fallout from that. Take a look at some baseball news. One team looking to use their own stadium for this spring training 2.0. And then, of course, the reigning champions there in Major League Baseball, the Washington Nationals, have announced when they will be unveiling their championship rings. So we'll talk about that as well. And then talked a couple days ago about an incident that happened in the Korean Soccer League, the K-League. And we have an update on that. If you missed it, I'll catch you up on what I talked about earlier this week and let you know what has come of that situation since. And then also some comments from the presidents of the American Hockey League that have been out for a little while, but they seem to, I mean, it just from where you would read them a week ago to how you might read it now might be a little different. But we'll talk about that as well, and then we'll end the day looking at some events that happened on this day in sports history. But first, wanted to start with all the news in the NFL around the Rooney Rule, with this gaining a lot of attention and a lot of traction right now, which is understandable. And yesterday, NFL owners approved some new measures that were aimed at improving those diversity hires in terms of head coaching and coordinator positions, as well as front office positions as well. Now, there was some talk, you know, to incentivize teams to hire, to make these diversity hires by including a 6-10 spot improvement for a third round draft pick should the team hire a diversity GM or head coach. But those talks were tabled. And that's an interesting idea to throw out there, because I think what all this talk has really shown us around the Rooney Rule and its changes is that there seems to be support, enough support for it, and there were some new measures passed, so we'll get into that a little later on in the segment, but there does seem to be support for this Rooney Rule change. But it also kind of shows you how difficult it is for diversity hires to get the attention in the NFL. And while it's always been kind of an issue, it's kind of disheartening, and I don't want to say disturbing, but it's disheartening and it's worrisome that it's still this big of a problem. The fact that there's only 4 minority head coaches in the NFL right now and 2 minority GMs in the NFL right now, that is just worrisome that, you know, you look at sports a lot of the time to try to knock down those walls, whether it's political or, you know, a racist issue. You look for sports and sports figures to sometimes be a leader in standing up or talking against whatever the issue might be. And something that all this talk and change about the Rooney Rule has shown me is that there seems to be some racism still in the NFL. And I'm not saying that that's the reason that minority hires aren't being hired, but it seems as though there's almost having to be too much of an incentive for teams to hire minority coaches or minority GMs, where you would hope that's not the case, especially nowadays. You would hope that it's not as much of a struggle or as much of a hurdle for these minority head coaches or minority GMs to find a job in the NFL, especially because of how front and center a lot of you know, black athletes are in the NFL. I mean, look at some of the more well-known athletes at whatever position, quarterback, wide receiver, linebacker, it doesn't matter. There's standout athletes all over the NFL, and a lot of them are African-American, and it just shocks you to see how they're trying to incentivize this whole program around the Rooney Rule when you would hope that that wouldn't have to be the case. I mean, to offer a 6 or 10 spot improvement, I really don't care what round of the draft you're talking about. that could be the difference between having another rebuilding year and possibly making a push to the playoffs. I mean, a 6 to 10 spot improvement. Imagine you have the 11th or 12th pick in the third round. Now all of a sudden you're picking maybe second or third in the third round. That could be huge. So for them to want to incentivize, and again, that was not one of the new measures that was passed, but there were talks about that, and those talks were tabled, meaning that they you know have been put to the side for a future date to talk about it more. But to see that kind of incentive talked about makes you a little worried that the problem is worse than maybe some thought in the NFL in terms of minority hires, and it shouldn't be. It really shouldn't be this day and age. So, I mean, that's, again, we're seeing support for changes and support to ways of opening the door for minority candidates, whether it's a head coaching job or an offensive or defensive or special teams coordinator positions or any kind of front office job. But it still gives you a little bit of a kind of a sick feeling in your stomach when you have to see that kind of an incentive put forward for teams to hire what could be great prospects and great candidates. So as much as I hope that these measures do pass and that minority head coaches and other positions, get looked at fairly and equally as they should already be doing. But again, all this incentive makes it look like it's a lot worse than what's maybe being led on to, or maybe what we've been led to believe. Because it's been an issue. Every time there's a hire, whether it's a head coach or a coordinator position, every time there's a hire, there's always a talk of race. And there was a lot of talk coming off of the virtual draft this year with all, you know, owners and head coaches, on camera and at their own homes. There was a lot of talk about how, you know, it was just a lot of white guys sitting around and making their draft picks, and very few minority hires. So you would hope that's not by design, but seeing, again, an incentive like that, like a 6 to 10 spot improvement, kind of makes you think that maybe there is. So hopefully we see more and more support for this, and Roger Goodell did say that there was a lot of good support, especially for that draft pick incentive, and he had a quote where he says, quote, "There was a great deal of support, but there were also some suggestions, amendments, and thoughts that we may want to go back and talk to others, including the Fritz Pollard Alliance, and try to strengthen it and try to make sure it does what we originally what we were originally intending, which is to reward teams and coaches for developing minority coaches that can go on to be head coaches in this league. End quote, which is what you would hope. You would hope that the best candidates and the best prospects to be head coaches down the line, regardless of race, regardless of your gender, regardless of your sexual preference, regardless of all that stuff, you would just hope, and we hope for this in almost every aspect of the professional world, whether it's in sports or in the medical field or in the legal field or wherever, you would hope that regardless of what someone's ethnicity is or race is, especially this day and age, wouldn't be a huge deal or wouldn't be something that keeps someone from being hired in a position. Obviously, we know racism still exists in the country. We're not breaking news to anybody by saying that. But you would hope, again, in the world where you look to sports athletes or sports figures to sometimes be the voice to say that, you know, we're gonna change this, we're gonna make sure that it's not the same way. You would hope that, you know, someone like the NFL can step up and they show that they are at least going down that road of making it so where you can get diversity hires and make sure that you know coaching prospects that could be a head coach later on are getting the right experience and the right kind of training and the right kind of mentorship so they can do that. And obviously it's been a problem in the NFL, and coming off the NFL draft it was talked about even more, and now we see the changes here to the Rooney Rule, and you know, again, it just makes you think that the problem is worse than we were originally led to believe. But like I said, there were some measures that were voted on and passed that will go into effect. Some of those are that teams will now be required to interview at least two candidates from outside their organization for any vacant head coaching job, and at least one minority candidate from outside their organization for any vacant offensive, defensive, or special teams coordinator job. Now, previously, you know, the Rooney Rule didn't require teams to interview one minority candidate for a head coach and none for a coordinator. So you're adding another candidate position to the head coaching job, and you're giving coordinators a chance, which is where a lot of, as we know, a lot of head coaches, future head coaches, come from, coordinators. Almost all of them do. Unless someone like a Matt Rhule goes from head coach of college to head coach in the pros, a lot of head coaches are coordinators before being head coaches. Take Ron Rivera, for instance. He was the defensive coordinator for the Chargers before he got the opportunity to be the head coach of the Panthers, now the head coach of the Redskins. So to see them opening up that door to the coordinator position, again, gives you hope that this is going to help the issue of minority coaches not getting the experience and the mentorship to then go on to be head coaches. So good to see that go into effect. Also, the NFL is changing its anti-tampering policy to relax the rules that have allowed teams to deny assistant coaches and executives the opportunity to interview for jobs with other organizations. So again, being a little more laxed in that area. That resolution, again, approved yesterday, according to the NFL, establishes a system that, quote, prohibits a club from denying, one, an assistant coach the opportunity to interview with a new team for a bona fide offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, or special teams coordinator position. And two, a non-high level/non-secondary football executive from interviewing for a bona fide assistant general manager position. Now, it requires every team to submit, and this, I think, is an interesting part of this. It requires every team to submit an organizational flow chart with descriptions of each coach's specific responsibilities and stipulates that any dispute over the definition of bona fide in those cases will be resolved by the commissioner, whether that gives you more hope or less hope, depending on your view of Goodell. That's another rule there. So, again, it allows, maybe somebody at a lower position or position with another team to go out and look for a job with another organization, whether that's for an assistant coach or for some kind of football executive position. That's again, a move, I think, in the right direction. And something else that was established was that the Rooney Rule is now expanded to apply to a number of executive positions as well. So teams in the league office are now required to interview minorities and or female applicants for positions such as team president and senior executives in communication, finance, human resources, legal, the legal team, football operations, sales, marketing, sponsorship, information technology, and security positions. So again, just opening up that whole door, every aspect of what goes into a football team is now, that door is now being opened for minority and female candidates, which again, you would hope would already kind of be in place, wouldn't have to be in writing, but if you need to do it, put it down. And they did, which again, I think is a really good position for them to be in. Then one other aspect that was voted and approved on is that each of the 32 NFL teams will establish a minority coaching fellowship program. The coaching fellowships are to be a full-time position, 1 or 2 years in length, to provide NFL legends, minority and female participants with hands-on training in NFL coaching. Again, that step to make sure that if a position opens, any candidate, regardless of race, sex, or whatever, is able to apply and can step in and do a great job in that position, which is what you want. I mean, you want to, the current head coaches and the current people that hold the power to develop the next generation, to develop the next wave of head coaches or executives or general managers. And again, you hope that they're not overly concerned about the race or the sex of that person. But again, if you have to put it in writing, go ahead and do it so that we can ensure that the best candidates and the best prospects for those positions are put in a position to succeed. Because if you do that, regardless of what business you're in, you're going to see success and you're going to set yourself up to carry on that success. So it's good to see that from the NFL. And again, hopefully it's not as big a problem as it's now starting to seem, But these are good steps in making sure that the NFL can go down a road where this problem is, I don't know if you want to say resolved, but maybe we go down a road where this isn't as big of a problem anymore and the talk isn't around how little minority coaches are being considered anymore. And it can actually boil down to who is the best candidate for whichever job, regardless of what your race or ethnicity is. So, little concerned about how much they've had to change this rule, but I'm also happy to see that these changes are being made, and hopefully we can see some brighter days for that Rooney rule down the line. But when we come back from the break, now that the last dance is in the book, we're starting to see some of the fallout from that from some of the players involved, one man specifically. So we'll talk about that coming up on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit Blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
You can't please everybody, right? That's an old saying that you just won't be able to make everybody happy. And that is proving to be true when it comes to the last dance as well. Even though a lot of us as fans enjoyed the documentary and enjoyed it a lot from kind of the in-depth look that we got at who Michael Jordan was more off the court, as well as who he was kind of in the locker room and the kind of teammate that he was and team leader that he was. And, you know, there were a lot of people saying as we were going into the documentary that you aren't going to like MJ anymore. You're not going to like him as much. You're going to see this different side of him, and it's not going to be as pleasant as maybe you thought it would be. And I think there were times where, yeah, I mean, if he's picking on a teammate or if he's really kind of going after one guy, maybe you think, hey, you know, why is he being so, or why is he trying to be so intimidating to this one person? But I think as we saw throughout the entire documentary, Michael Jordan was just that kind of person. Talking about his competitive edge, how he would find the littlest things to give him a little more ammo to go out there and play harder. And how he had this win-at-all-cost mentality. And if you didn't have that, he was either going to push you to a point where you had it at to some level that was, you know, approved by MJ, or that you were, you know, just so sick of it that you were going to, you know, try to leave the team or just be done with basketball. I mean, it was never, I don't think it was ever come out that was, you know, the other end goal was maybe to push somebody so hard they didn't want to be there. But that's kind of where, you know, it felt like it was coming from. Either have the same edge, have the same desire, or don't be there. And I think there are times where during the documentary you might look at MJ and think, wow, that was kind of a jerk move. But you also have to balance that, I think, with how much he was trying to carry a team and also have to carry all of the weight of being Michael Jordan in terms of the social responsibility, how you know, portray yourself to the fans and to the public and handling all the media attention. But there was one man, Horace Grant, who was featured a good amount in the documentary because he was with the Chicago Bulls during their first three-peat from 91 to 93. And then went on to play for the Magic later on in his career, running into the Bulls, actually, as we saw in that documentary. But he is less than pleased with some of the comments Michael Jordan made about him in the documentary. And again, you're not going to please everybody. But Horace Grant seems especially displeased by how he was portrayed and how Michael Jordan was talking about him. Specifically, the one thing he brought up that seemed to have started this whole thing of him kind of being displeased was that he called MJ, or he said that MJ was lying about him being leaking the info to Sam Smith for his famous Jordan Rules book. I think it was pretty early on, I want to say maybe within the first two episodes of the documentary series, that was covered, because the Detroit Pistons, the bad boys, the Detroit Pistons, had their infamous Jordan Rules. And Horace Grant has come back and said that he and Sam Smith and their relationship and their friendship had nothing to do with Sam Smith's book, and that Horace Grant would respect the integrity of the locker room he was a part of at the time with Chicago, and that he wouldn't just go and start talking to Sam Smith about the stuff maybe covered in the locker room. And those, you know, hearing MJ, you know, saying that it was Horace's fault, and you know, the fact that Sam Smith got that information was on Horace Grant and you know, being his fault, really got to him. I think it was the catalyst to the rest of what Horace Grant said, because he was on a radio interview with a show called Cap and Co on ESPN 1000 in Chicago yesterday. And it seems as though he went off on a few different things. I mean, that was one of the main things was he was upset that Jordan kind of called him a snitch, and that he was the reason that Sam Smith got the information for this Jordan Rules book. But he also went on to talk about a few other things. He talked about, you know, things that he didn't really see as necessary to be put into the documentary. One of those things talking about, you know, how Jordan kind of called Grant, you know, putting him in that kind of snitch's role of talking to Sam Smith. Horace Grant kind of went on to say that, you know, MJ bringing up the fact that during his rookie year, going to other guys' hotel rooms and seeing drugs out there, or having, you know, women of the night, let's say, in these rooms, you know, there was no reason to bring that up. And that Jordan was kind of snitching on his teammates and his past teammates in that instance, which, okay, yeah, I mean, it's not really a part of the basketball story. So yeah, why feel the need to bring up what your teammates are doing your rookie year, unless it shaped him? I mean, that's another thing. If he saw this and saw kind of the way that pro basketball players were living at the time, that maybe had shaped his drive even more. So that could be a reason to bring it up. You can see where Horace Grant's coming from in some case there. Also, says he was pretty upset by the way Scottie Pippen was portrayed. And there was a report, as I try to find it now, because I have the immense talent of losing all my notes that I write down. Here we go. Because Jackie McMullen wrote earlier this month that Pippen has been stung by his portrayal in the documentary. And if you think about kind of two, or I guess one instance that really stands out that you can understand, and this is the instance that Horace Grant pointed out as well. When Jordan had left the team initially, when he went to go chase the baseball dream, how Scottie Pippen really took over in those 94 playoffs, when they were going up against the Knicks and Scottie Pippen wasn't going to get the last shot. I forget in which game, but it was a close game, and Phil Jackson, I think, elected to go with Tony Kukoc and instead wasn't going to go with Pippen. Pippen took himself out of the game and said he wasn't going to play. And Horace Grant brought up the point of, hey, why have that in there if Jordan's not even on the team at the point? You know, Bill Cartwright goes ahead and calls Pippen out in the locker room. Pippen apologizes for it, and they go on and take the Knicks to seven games. So in what I think what Horace Grant is pulling up is, why even put Scottie Pippen in that kind of light when it's not like it was an issue that festered over the whole series? It's not like Pippen took himself out and then stayed out and kind of fought the team as to why he did it and his reasonings behind it. He knew that night after the game in the locker room that he made a mistake and that he let the team down. And you had someone like Bill Cartwright call him out. Scottie apologized. The team, you know, rallies and gets back in it. And really, it is a kind of a positive light for that Chicago Bulls team as a whole without Jordan, that you don't need that one voice. That team without Jordan still had voices that were able to pick other guys up, guys like Scottie Pippen. And so you can see kind of points like that and start to maybe get an idea of where Horace Grant's coming from. And he also, I mean, Grant really kind of lays into what he calls a so-called documentary, which, I mean, that shows up at least four or five times in the conversation that he had with Cap and Company. And talking about, and you know, with that instance of, you know, all this stuff that he was just going off about with Michael Jordan, this so-called documentary, and they asked him about that, You know, why are you calling it a so-called documentary? And that was really interesting point that he brought up, that two of Michael Jordan's kind of close confidants are were executive producers on the show. I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this man's name right, and I apologize to him if I don't pronounce it right. Este Portnoy and Curtis Polk were executive producers on the docuseries, and they are two of Jordan's closest confidants, according to Horace Grant. So Grant started to make the assumption that, you know, MJ may have had final say over creative and what was shown and what wasn't, and that, you know, all of the instances where MJ was being shown as kind of this tough guy to Horace Grant, Grant said that if anyone, including MJ, were to try to come at him, he would not be afraid to put him back down or come back at them. And it just makes you wonder kind of, you know, maybe how much creative control MJ did have over the project, because it didn't mention any other players. It just says in the article and in the report that, you know, Horace Grant, one of a few former players that aren't happy with the way they were portrayed in the film. So you just wonder how much, you know, truth is to that. And you can see maybe with how fragile, I want to say fragile, actually, that sounds like the wrong word, but with how much MJ was in the spotlight during this time, and how much that those two Bulls runs are synonymous with MJ, you wonder if he did feel a little protective of this documentary, of the story of that team and his run with Chicago. And you wonder if there maybe was some creative control being input by Michael Jordan. And the director has said that's not true, that MJ wasn't able, you know, he wasn't calling shots or anything like that. But just an interesting point of view from Horace Grant, that he thinks, you know, MJ had some say in this, and that it really wasn't the story of the Bulls. It was more the story of Michael Jordan and you know, the way he played while with the Bulls, and it just makes you wonder. I mean, again, you're not going to please everybody in a documentary, especially. You would think would be the best way to try and do that, to tell everyone's story as fairly as possible, but it sounds like a lot of players didn't think they were portrayed fairly. And we haven't heard a lot from Pippen or Rodman since, or at least we haven't heard a lot from Pippen since this documentary has finished airing, and you wonder what the relationship might be like moving forward after this, now between Jordan and Pippen and Rodman and Jackson and all these guys that were involved. Because, you know, Grant has made the point that there was a lot of pushback against Jordan, and we kind of saw that after the first few episodes when MJ talked about Scottie Pippen and not, you know, timing his surgery so he can come back and start playing at the beginning of the 97-98 season. But even Steve Kerr, I think the next day, came out and said not all of us had a problem with that. MJ did, but not all of us did. So again, that makes you wonder a little bit of how much say Michael Jordan did have, and it just makes you wonder a little bit. But you're not going to please everybody. Horace Grant, obviously not pleased. But we'll see if anything else comes from that. I doubt it really will, but you never know. We'll see if we get any kind of rebuttal from MJ, or if Pippen or Rodman decide to come out and say something. But just interesting to start to see some of the fallout from that documentary series. So we'll see if that continues. But coming up next, some baseball news. One team looking to stay in their home stadium for spring training 2.0. And the reigning champions unveiling where you can find or where you can see their ring for the first time. That's coming up on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
Well, as all sports try to figure out their return to play plan, we know Major League Baseball is a part of that. We know a few things here and there about the plan, including that spring training 2.0, those few weeks that they're trying to give players from middle of June to the end of June, so they can look to maybe get started early July there for their start of their season. So with that, of course, you know, where do these teams conduct spring training? Do they go back to their stadiums either in Arizona or Florida? They do it at their home stadiums. What would be the best way to do that? Well, the Texas Rangers, would prefer to stay at their home stadium. With that, instead of going back to Arizona, they can use their state-of-the-art facility there with their brand new stadium, that Globe Life Park in Arlington. So they can use all of that. They also have their former ballpark right across the street that has been redecorated in a way for the short-lived XFL return where the Dallas Renegades played there. But it still has, it has brand new AstroTurf laid down, so you could use it for throwing, you could use it for conditioning if you wanted to, maybe batting practice. So they have two gigantic stadiums, essentially, with, two workout rooms in the new stadium, one workout room in the old stadium, so you have three different weight rooms that you could use as well. So not every team is going to have that luxury, but I think for Texas, I think the best thing to do would not make these teams travel again. If they can do these workouts at their home stadium, I think that would be the easiest way to do it. Instead of trying to organize and orchestrate all these different teams again, flying to Arizona or Florida and going through that whole process again, it's just going to take up more time. So why not have them have spring training 2.0 at their own stadiums? And yeah, that's going to include a lot of inter-squad scrimmages, but I feel like that's where they were going already with that. There wasn't a whole lot of talk of having games in this spring training 2.0. So even if Texas stayed at their own stadium and relied more on inter-squad scrimmages, they might be doing that anyway in Arizona. So escape the heat, use your own two venues and facilities, and then get ready for your season to start, hopefully in early July. So I'm totally good with that. I think, again, it's the smarter decision for Major League Baseball. You're already having to decide how to restart your season, and instead of worrying how to possibly send teams to a whole different location before having that season start, just have them do it at their own stadium. Now, if stay-at-home orders in a certain state still prevents that, then yeah, you would have to look at a different option, which could be going to Arizona or Florida to restart your spring training. But I think teams like the Texas Rangers that can do it at their home stadium should. Because again, you keep a team in their own area. You're not endangering them by traveling or having to go to another hotel and worrying about what kind of contact they could endure throughout that process. So I think it would be smarter for Major League Baseball to have these teams, if they can, at their own home stadiums, especially with talk of this restart plan, including games being played at teams' home stadium. So imagine if you take Texas away or take the Rangers away from Texas, go to Arizona for spring training, then you just fly them back to Texas to play their games. Why? Why have that whole other travel incorporated and involved when you don't really have to? So if teams are in states where they can practice and go out to their own home stadium and have spring training 2.0 there, I think that would be the best way to do it, and you can just jump right into the season. Because if you play at home, boom, there you go. You're already there. You're already ready for the game. You're already ready for your season to then start, instead of having to worry to travel to Arizona or Florida and then travel back and start your season there. So I think it's a smart idea. I think if a team prefers to do that, they should be allowed to do that. I mean, we already know this season is going to take on a whole different feel. So why try to throw more wrenches into the system? So I think that would be the easiest way and the less chaotic way for these teams to go through spring training if they have that opportunity. So I'm all for it. Good luck, Rangers. But speaking of other baseball news, the Washington Nationals, of course, coming off their World Series championship season. So, of course, a big part of that is your championship rings. When do you get them? How will they look? Obviously, it seems like almost every year the championship rings get more and more expensive and more extravagant. But nonetheless, the Nationals will unveil their 2019 World Series rings in a virtual event this Sunday. The Nationals said that it'll be an hour-long event starting at 4 o'clock here on the West Coast, 7 p.m. East Coast time. It'll be streamed on the team's website and their social channels, as well as airing on MLB Network. If you are a Washington Nationals fan here on the West Coast, there's your opportunity to watch. So this Sunday, they will do that. They'll have several members from the winning team, as you would imagine, players, maybe some coaches, ownership. They'll all be making appearances to talk about you know, the season and their championship win. And there's been some crazy rings out there throughout sports history. I mean, think about some of these teams like the 2009 Pittsburgh Steelers. They went all out and put six big diamonds on their rings to show the significance of their historic championships. You know, you look at all the way back to the New York Yankees in 2009 as well. They had the ring featured classic interlocking New York logo in the middle of a baseball diamond with the whole image of that covered in real diamonds. I mean, it's just crazy. Of course, the Miami Heat got together, so the Heat's 2013 ring design included both of their NBA Finals trophies along with a sleek black and white design the team had embraced on their uniforms during that time period. So no real talk of diamonds there, but still just the design of it is pretty impressive. Think about the Detroit Red Wings back in 2008, where they had each of the team's 11 Stanley Cups with the corresponding year built into the side of the ring, which was a diamond-studded Red Wings logo as well, made its appearance on that championship ring. So you just get unbelievable type of championship rings nowadays. So it's almost become part of the experience of winning a championship. As much as the parade is and raising the banner is, you want to see those rings and you want to see how they look and how many diamonds are just crammed into them. You know, those massive championship rings, which most of the time they're so gaudy the players won't even wear them. So they just end up sitting in a trophy case or somewhere in the house. But nonetheless, it's always intriguing to see what they look like and what the style of it will be. So I imagine that there's going to have to be something about the state capitol or something that's involved in the ring, you know, being in Washington, D.C. But we'll have to wait and see. We'll find out this Sunday what those championship rings look like. And that's like I said, it's becoming just as big of a part of sports as winning the actual championship. So it's a cool way to continue to celebrate. But we're going to take a break. When we come back, the K-League, after its certain incident with FC Seoul, has announced the punishment there. And some interesting comments from the president of the American Hockey League. So we'll talk about that coming up on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
I talked a few days ago about an incident over in South Korea with the K-League, which is the top tier of Korean soccer, and FC Seoul, one of its more popular, well-known, and a pretty successful club over there, made a bit of a no-no. They were trying, I mean, if you've watched the KBO at all, the Korean Baseball League, then you have seen them put, you know, like cutouts of people, or they'll try to find different ways to simulate people being there in the crowd. Well, FC Seoul tried to do that as well at a recent game, and they thought they were using mannequins to do that. Ended up, they were sex dolls, because one of the bigger fans of FC Seoul owns a company that makes those. So, you know, that was something that social media locked on to very quickly when seeing the dolls in the stands for the game. And it was reported that, I mean, with the K-League being against any kind of advertising like that, or any kind of adult-themed entertainment or something like that being present at their games, it was said that FC Seoul could be in a position to receive a hefty fine, and that's exactly what they got. FC Seoul was hit with a K-League record fine of $82,000. For, quote, damaging the prestige and integrity of the league, end quote. So, yeah, big-time message sent there. They don't want it in their league, and they're not going to have it in their league, because if they do, that's what you're going to see. Now, FC Seoul, being one of the more, you know, popular clubs over there, will be able to survive that fine, but that is a huge fine. I mean, $82,000, that is a big five-digit number right there. And, You know, the investigation found that FC Seoul did not intentionally put the sex dolls in the crowd. They did, you know, they were in the mindset of that they ordered mannequins, that this would be the, you know, that's what they would be getting and putting into the stands. But that is not the case. And they were hit with a hefty fine there, and they could see even future punishment as well because of this, because they do not own the stadium they play in. They, you know, they rent that out as you know, to be able to play there. And some of the dolls had signs that would say, like, go team or whatever. But they also, some of the dolls also had signs that were advertising either that company or different companies kind of that nature. And that's a no-no because they have to get advanced permission, any team does, before placing new advertising or bringing new advertising into that stadium. So if they're found guilty of that, they could face expulsion from using that stadium. So they would have to find a totally different home to play in. And you would imagine that that's, you know, that would be, that wouldn't be a horrible thing to do, to go find a different place to play in. I'm sure there's other stadiums in the area. But just the embarrassment of that, this record fine, and you get expelled from the stadium you've called home. And it would just not be a good look for FC Seoul. But, you know, we talk all of the time, and you know, I don't want to keep bringing this up, but we talked back earlier this year and into last year when the Astros cheating scandal came up, and I talked about how I wasn't a big fan of the way, you know, Major League Baseball went about handling that and handling the punishment of it. I got to take my hat off to K-League. I mean, they launched an investigation. They found that this was a mistake. It wasn't an intentional mistake by FC Seoul. This was a mistake that they do not, you know, handle, and they do not let slip by. So they made FC Seoul pay for it, literally, $82,000. But now this is also going down the road of, you know, hey, if you decided to you know, if you brought in advertising as well, you could face an even bigger issue with expulsion from your stadium. And while I'm sure there are other stadiums in the area, there's no guarantee that they'd be able to play at those stadiums all the time. So they could go from this kind of established team at this established stadium to being kind of a traveling road show of sorts for soccer, which no team would really enjoy being. If you want to be taken as kind of a serious championship contending team, you don't want to be the team known for playing at all these different stadiums throughout your season. So we could be looking at even more punishment for FC Seoul, and you know, definitely K-League definitely sending a message not to mess with this you know, by any means or for any reason. So you gotta give them hats off for that. Then quickly wanted to talk about the American Hockey League, the AHL. As David Andrews last week, who is the league president, said that he would not rule out the 2020-2021 season having less than 31 teams participating if fans aren't allowed to return to arenas. The AHL does have 19 NHL-owned teams and then 12 independently-owned teams. And the report said that those teams were in good financial position, even though the remainder of the 19-20 season got canceled. But they have said, David Andrews had pointed out that, you know, they rely a lot on fans coming through the doors, and, you know, kind of like what everyone's been talking about with college sports. They rely a lot on the people coming through the turnstiles and paying to be there and watching those games. So if fans can't do that, then he could see some of the teams choosing not to play, which has been talked about in a lot of other, I mean, I feel like a little bit at least in some of the other sports leagues, where players might not feel comfortable stepping into any kind of position to play a game, you know, with the current coronavirus situation going around. And, you know, while players think about safety and health, and even though owners and GMs are too, they have to think about the money aspect as well. So if you don't want to risk players' health and you're not going to make money, don't play. And it'll be interesting to see the reaction, the backlash possibly to that. But I think it's a position you can understand. It's something that doesn't really shock me with what's been going on. But it would be interesting to see season that they're planning on having start in October, but they're prepping for possible starts also in November, December, or January, for their season to start. But it will be interesting to see kind of how that evolves, and if fans aren't allowed, maybe what teams, because you would think the independent teams would be the ones first besides the NHL-owned teams, although we don't know how NHL is going to look coming out of this, if they'll finish this season or just look to start next season on time, or what that plan might look like. But it'll be definitely interesting to see how, if teams elect not to play, how that affects how the league operates and how the sport is kind of received that season. So I thought that was interesting comments, and we'll see how it all plays out. But, not surprised that we're seeing some teams at lower levels take that stance that if we can't make money, why would we risk it? And that's fair. That's totally fair. In my opinion, at least, I think that's fair. But we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll wrap up the show today, taking a look at some events that happened on this day in sports history. So stay tuned for that here on the Spencer Wilson Show on ESPN Radio, 94.5 FM.
Is your technology infrastructure meeting the demands of your customers, your employees, you? How does your network scale to support your growth plans? With distribution hiding behind every corner, it's time you benefited from a network and security provider that will guide your organization through rapid technology change. Blackfoot, here to enable what's next. Visit Blackfoot.com/SDWAN to learn more.
All right, as we wrap up this Wednesday show, take a look at some events that happened on this day in sports history. We'll start in 1920 when policemen raid the Cubs bleachers and arrest 24 fans for gambling. Oh, how seedy it was. On this day in 1983, American heavyweight boxer Larry Holmes beats his fellow countryman Tim Witherspoon by split decision to retain his WBC title at the Dunes Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas. Also on this day in 1983, Michael Doakes and Mike Weaver fight to a draw in a 15-round fight for the heavyweight boxing title. On this day in 1984, Boston's Roger Clemens beats the Twins 5-4 for his first major league victory. On this day in 1988, Mike Schmidt hits his 535th home run, moving him into eighth place all time. On this day in 1991, speaking of the Bulls, Michael Jordan is named NBA's MVP. What else we got going on here? On this day in 2015, NASCAR 2016 Hall of Fame inductees were announced. Those were Bobby Isaac, Terry Labonte, and Jerry Cook. And then also on this day in 2018, the tradition of senior men's golf at Greystone Golf and Country Club, Spaniard Miguel and Hel Jimenez wins by 3 strokes from American trio Joe Durant, Steve Stricker, and Gene Sawyers. That is the show. Thank you so much for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll be back on the air tomorrow at 2 o'clock, so be sure to tune in then, and we'll talk to you then. Have a great rest of your hump day. Peace.